This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Next by Michael Crichton. Read by Dylan Baker. Copyright 2006 by Michael Crichton. Production copyright 2006 by HarperCollins Publishers. Grateful acknowledgement is made for permission to reprint the following. It's All Over Now, written by Bobby Womack and Shirley Womack, published by ABKCO Music, Inc., copyright 1964, renewed ABKCO Music, Inc. This novel is fiction, except for the parts that aren't. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. Steven Weinberg. The word cause is an altar to an unknown God. William James. What is not possible is not to choose. Jean-Paul Sartre. Prologue. Vasco Borden, 49, tugged at the lapels of his suit and straightened his tie as he walked down the plush carpeted hallway. He wasn't used to wearing a suit, though he had had this one in Navy specially tailored to minimize the muscular bulk of his body. Borden was big, 6'4", 240, an ex-football player, who worked as a private investigator and fugitive recovery specialist. And right now, Vasco was following his man, a 30-year-old balding postdoc, a fugitive from microproteomics of Cambridge, Mass., as he headed right for the main room of the conference. The BioChange 2006 conference, enthusiastically entitled Make It Happen Now, was being held at the Venetian Hotel in Las Vegas. The 2,000 attendees represented all sorts of biotech workers, including investors, HR officers who hired scientists, technology transfer officers, CEOs, and intellectual property attorneys. In one way or another, nearly every biotech company in America was represented here. It was the perfect place for the fugitive to meet his contact. The fugitive looked like a dink. He had an innocent face and a little soul patch on his chin. He slouched when he walked and gave the impression of timidity and ineptitude. But the fact was, he'd made off with 12 transgenic embryos in a cryogenic dewar and transported them across country to this conference, where he intended to turn them over to whomever he was working for. It wouldn't be the first time a postdoc got tired of working on salary, or the last. The fugitive went over to the check-in table to get his conference card to drape around his neck. Vasco hung by the entrance, slipping his own card over his head. He'd come prepared for this. He pretended to look at the event roster. The big speeches were all in the main ballroom. Seminars were scheduled for such topics as fine-tune your recruiting process and winning strategies to keep research talent, executive and equity compensation, corporate governance and the SEC, patent office trends, and investor angels, boon or curse, and finally, trade secrets piracy. Protect yourself now. Much of Vasco's work involved high-tech firms. He had been to these conferences before. Either they were about science or business. This one was business. The fugitive, whose name was Eddie Tolman, walked past him into the ballroom. Vasco followed. Tolman went down a few rows and dropped into a seat with no one nearby. Vasco slipped into the row behind and sat a little to one side. The Tolman kid checked his cell phone for text messages, then seemed to relax and looked up to listen to the speech. Vasco wondered why. The man at the podium was one of the most famous venture capitalists in California, a legend in high-tech investment, Jack B. Watson. Watson's face was blown up large on the screen behind him, his trademark suntan and striking good looks magnified to fill the room. Watson was a young-looking 52 and assiduously cultivated his reputation as a capitalist with a conscience. That appellation had carried him through a succession of ruthless business deals. All the media ever showed were his appearances at charter schools or handing out scholarships for underprivileged kids. But in this room, Vasco knew, Watson's reputation for tough deal-making would be foremost in everyone's mind. He wondered if Watson was ruthless enough to acquire a dozen transgenic embryos by illicit means. He probably was. However, at the moment, Watson was cheerleading. "Biotechnology is booming! We are poised to see the greatest growth of any industry since computers 30 years ago. The largest biotech company, Amgen, in Los Angeles, employs 7,000 people. Federal grants to universities exceed $4 billion a year on campuses from New York to San Francisco, Boston to Miami. Venture capitalists invest in biotech companies at a rate of $5 billion a year. The lure of magnificent cures made possible by stem cells, cytokines, and proteomics are drawing the brightest talent to the field. And with a global population growing older by the minute, our future is brighter than ever. And that's not all. We've reached the point where we can stick it to Big Pharma, and we will. Those massive, bloated companies need us, and they know it. They need genes. They need technology. They're in the past. We're the future. We're where the money is." That drew huge applause. Vasco shifted his bulk in his seat. The audience was applauding, even though they knew that this son of a bitch would cut their company to pieces in a second if it suited his bottom line. "Of course, we face obstacles to our progress. Some people, however well-intentioned they think they are, choose to stand in the way of human betterment. They don't want the paralyzed to walk, the cancer patient to thrive, the sick child to live and play. These people have their reasons for objecting, religious, ethical, or even practical. But whatever their reasons, they are on the side of death, and they will not triumph." More thunderous applause. Vasco glanced at the fugitive, Tolman. The kid was checking his phone again, evidently waiting for a message, and waiting impatiently. Did that mean the contact was late? That was sure to make Tolman nervous, because somewhere, Vasco knew, this kid had stashed a stainless steel thermos of liquid nitrogen that held the embryos. It wasn't in the kid's room. Vasco had already searched it. And 5 days had passed since Tolman left Cambridge. The coolant wouldn't last forever. And if the embryos thawed, they would be worthless. So unless Tolman had a way to top up his LN2, by now he must be anxious to retrieve his container and hand it over to his buyer. It had to happen soon. Within an hour, Vasco was sure of it. "Of course, people will try to obstruct progress," Watson said from the podium. "Even our best companies find themselves embroiled in pointless, unproductive litigation. One of my startups, Biogen in Los Angeles, is in court right now because some guy named Burnett thinks he doesn't need to honor the contracts he himself signed, because now he's changed his mind. Burnett is trying to block medical progress unless we pay him. An extortionist whose daughter is the lawyer handling the case for him, keeping it in the family," Watson smiled. "But we will win the Burnett case, because progress cannot be stopped." At that, Watson threw both hands up in the air, waving to the audience as applause filled the room. He almost acts like a candidate, Vasco thought. Is that what Watson was aiming for? The guy certainly had enough money to get elected. Being rich was essential in American politics these days. Pretty soon, he looked over and saw that the Tolman kid was gone. The seat was empty. Shit. Progress is our mission, our sacred calling, Watson cried. Progress to vanquish disease. Progress to halt aging, banish dementia, extend life. A life free of disease, decay, pain, and fear. The great dream of humanity made real at last. Vasco Borden wasn't listening. He was heading down the row toward the side aisle, scanning the exit doors. A couple of people leaving, nobody looking like Tolman. The guy couldn't have gotten away. There was... He looked back just in time to see Tolman moving slowly up the center aisle. The kid was looking at his cell phone again. 60 billion this year, 200 billion next year, 500 billion in 5 years. That is the future of our industry, and that is the prospect we bring to all mankind. The crowd suddenly rose to its feet, giving Watson a standing ovation, and for a moment Vasco could no longer see Tolman at all. But only for a moment. Now Tolman was making for the center exit. Vasco turned away, slipping through the side door and out into the lobby, just as Tolman came blinking into the bright lobby light. Tolman glanced at his watch and headed down the far corridor, past big glass windows that looked out on the red brick campanile of San Marco, recreated by the Venetian Hotel and lit brilliantly at night. He was going toward the swimming pool area, or perhaps the courtyard. This time of night, those spaces would be crowded. Vasco stayed close. This was it, he thought. In the ballroom, Jack Watson paced back and forth, smiling and waving at the cheering crowd. Thank you. That's very kind. Thank you. Ducking his head a little each time he said it. Just the right amount of modesty. Rick Deal snorted in disgust as he watched. Deal was backstage, taking it all in on a little black-and-white monitor. Deal was the 34-year-old CEO of Biogen Research, a struggling startup in Los Angeles, and this performance by his most important outside investor filled him with unease. Because Deal knew that despite the cheerleading and the press releases with smiling black kids, at the end of the day, Jack Watson was a true bastard. As someone put it, the best I can say about Watson is he's not a sadist. He's just a first-class son of a bitch. Deal had accepted funding from Watson with the greatest reluctance. He wished he didn't need it. Deal's wife was wealthy, and he had started Biogen with her money. His first venture as CEO had been to bid on a cell line being licensed by UCLA. It was the so-called Burnett cell line, developed from a man named Frank Burnett, whose body produced powerful cancer-fighting chemicals called cytokines. Deal hadn't really expected to land the license, but he did. And suddenly he faced the prospect of gearing up for FDA approval for clinical trials. The cost of clinical trials started at $1 million and went rapidly to $10 million a pop, not counting downstream costs and after-marketing expenses. He could no longer rely solely on his wife's money. He needed outside financing. That was when he discovered just how risky venture capitalists considered cytokines to be. Many cytokines, such as interleukins, had taken years to come to market, and many others were known to be dangerous, even deadly to patients. And then Frank Burnett had brought a lawsuit casting doubt on Biogen's ownership of the cell line. Deal had trouble getting investors to even meet with him. In the end, he had to accept smiling, suntanned Jack Watson. But Watson, Deal knew, wanted nothing less than to take over Biogen and throw Rick Deal out on his ass. Jack, fantastic speech, fantastic. Rick extended his hand as Watson came backstage at last. Yeah, glad you liked it. Watson didn't shake his hand. Instead, he unclipped his wireless transmitter and dropped it in Deal's palm. Take care of this, Rick.
Sure, Jack.
Your wife here?
No. Karen couldn't make it. Deal shrugged. Thing with the kids.
I'm sorry she missed this speech, Watson said.
I'll see she gets the DVD, Deal said.
But we got the bad news out there, Watson said. That's the point. Everybody now knows there's a lawsuit. They know Burnett is a bad guy, and they know we're on top of it. That's the important thing. The company's now perfectly positioned.
Deal said, Is that why you agreed to give the speech?
Watson stared at him. You think I want to come to Vegas? Christ. He unclipped the microphone, handed it to Deal. Take care of this, too.
Sure, Jack.
And Jack Watson turned and walked away from him without another word. Rick Deal shivered.
Thank God for Karen's money, he thought, because without it, he'd be doomed.
Passing through the arches of the Doge's palace, Vasco Borden moved into the courtyard, following his fugitive, Eddie Tolman, through the nighttime crowd. He heard his earpiece crackle. That would be his assistant, Dolly, in another part of the hotel. He touched his ear.
Go,
he said.
Baldy boy Tolman has reserved some entertainment.
Is that right?
That's right. He...
Hold on,
Vasco said.
Just hold that thought.
Up ahead, he was seeing something he could not believe. From the right side of the courtyard, he saw Jack B. Watson, accompanied by a beautiful, slinky, dark-haired woman, merging with the crowd. Watson was famous for always being accompanied by gorgeous women. They all worked for him. They were all smart, and they were all stunning. The woman didn't surprise Vasco. What surprised him was that Jack Watson was heading directly toward Eddie Tolman, the fugitive. That made no sense at all. Even if Tolman were doing a deal with Watson, the famous investor would never meet him face to face, and certainly never in public. But there they were, on a collision course in the crowded Venetian courtyard right before his eyes. What the hell? He couldn't believe it was going to happen. But then the slinky woman stumbled a bit and stopped. She was wearing a short, skin-tight dress and heels. She leaned on Watson's shoulder, bent her knee, showing plenty of leg, and inspected her shoe. She adjusted her heel strap, stood up again, and smiled at Watson. And Vasco glanced away from them and saw that Tolman was gone. But now Watson and the woman crossed Vasco's own path, passing so close to him that he could smell her perfume. And he heard Watson murmur something to her, and she squeezed his arm and put her head on his shoulder as they walked. The romantic couple. Was all that an accident? Had it happened on purpose? Had they made him? He pressed his earpiece.
Dolly, I lost him.
No prob. I got him.
He glanced up. She was on the second floor, watching everything below.
Was that Jack Watson that just walked by?
Yeah. I thought maybe...
No, no, Dolly said. I can't imagine Watson's involved in this. Not his style. I mean, Baldy Boy is heading for his room because he has an appointment. That's what I was telling you. He got some entertainment.
Namely?
Russian girl. Apparently he only likes Russians. Tall ones.
Anybody we know?
No. But I have a little information, and I got cameras in his suite.
How'd you do that?
He was smiling.
Let's just say Venetian security isn't what it used to be. Cheaper, too.
Irina Katayeva, 22, knocked on the door. In her left hand she held a bottle of wine, encased in a velvet gift bag with drawstrings at the top. A guy of about 30 answered the door, smiled. He wasn't attractive.
Are you Eddie?
That's right. Come on in.
I bought this for you from the hotel safe.
She handed him the wine. Watching all this on his little handheld video monitor, Vasco said, She gave it to him in the hallway.
where it would be seen on the security monitor. Why didn't she wait until she was in the room?
Maybe she was told to do it that way, Dolly said.
She must be 6 feet. What do we know about her?
Good English. 4 years in this country, studying at the university.
Works at the hotel?
No.
So, non-pro? Vasco said.
This is Nevada, Dolly said.
On the monitor, the Russian girl went into the room and the door closed. Vasco turned the tuning dial on his video monitor, picked up one of the inside cameras. The kid had a big suite, close to 2,000 square feet, done in the Venetian style. The girl nodded and smiled.
Nice. Nice room.
Yeah, so you want a drink?
She shook her head.
I don't really have time.
She reached behind her back and unzipped the dress, left it hanging from her shoulders. She turned around, pretending to be puzzled, allowing him to see her bare back all the way down to her buttocks.
Which way is the bedroom?
This way, baby.
As they went into the bedroom, Vasco again turned the dials. He saw the bedroom just as she was saying,
I don't know anything about your business, and I don't want to know. Business is so boring.
She let the dress fall. She stepped out of it and lay down on the bed, naked now except for the high heels. She kicked them off.
I don't think you'll need a drink, she said, and I know I don't.
Tolman threw himself on her, landing with a kind of thud. She grunted and tried to smile.
Easy, boy.
He was panting, gasping. He reached for her hair to caress her.
Leave the hair alone, she said.
She twisted away.
Just lie down, she said, and let me make you happy.
Oh, hell, Vasco said, staring at the tiny screen. Do you believe that? You ain't even a minute man. When a woman looks like that, you'd think...
Never mind, Dolly said over the headset. She's getting dressed now.
So she is, he said. And rather hurriedly, too.
She's supposed to give him half an hour. And if he paid her, I didn't see it.
Me neither. But he's getting dressed, too.
Something's up, Dolly said. She's walking out the door.
Vasco thumbed the tuner, trying to change to a different camera. All he got was static.
I can't see shit.
She's leaving. He's still there. No, wait. He's leaving, too.
Yeah?
Yeah. And he's taking the wine bottle with him.
Okay, Vasco said. And where's he going with it?
Frozen embryos in liquid nitrogen were transported in a special stainless steel thermos lined with borosilicate glass called a dewar. Dewars were mostly big affairs, shaped like milk jugs, but you could get them as small as a liter. A dewar didn't have the shape of a wine bottle because they had a wide mouth cap, but it would be about the same size and would fit in a wine sack for sure.
He must be carrying it, Vasco said. It must be in the sack.
I figure, Dolly said. You see him yet?
Yeah, I do.
Vasco picked up the couple on the ground floor near the gondola stand. They walked arm in arm, the guy carrying the wine bottle in the crook of his arm, keeping it upright. It was an awkward way to carry it, and they made an odd-looking pair, the beautiful girl and the diffident, slouchy guy. They walked along the canal, hardly glancing at the shops as they passed them.
On their way to a meeting, Vasco said.
I see him,
Dolly said. Vasco looked down the crowded street and saw Dolly at the far end. Dolly was 28 and completely ordinary looking. Dolly could be anybody, an accountant, girlfriend, secretary, assistant. She could always pass. Tonight she was dressed Vegas style, teased blonde hair and a sparkly dress with cleavage. She was a little overweight, which made the impression perfect. Vasco had been with her for 4 years now, and they worked well as a team. In private life, they got along only okay. She hated that he smoked cigars in bed.
Heading for the hall, Dolly said.
No, they're doubling back.
The main hall was a huge oval passageway, high gilded ceiling, soft lights, marble pillars. It dwarfed the crowds that moved through it. Vasco hung back.
Changed their mind? Or they made us?
I think they're being careful.
Well, this is the big moment.
Because even more than catching the fugitive, they had to know whom he was turning the embryos over to. Obviously someone at the conference.
Won't be long now, Dolly said.
Rick Deal was walking back and forth along the shops by the gondola canal, holding his cell phone in his hand. He ignored the stores, which were filled with expensive stuff of the sort he never wanted. Deal had grown up as the third son of a Baltimore physician. All the other boys went to medical school and became obstetricians like their father. Deal refused and went into medical research. Family pressure eventually drove him to move west. He did genetic research at UCSF for a while, but he was more intrigued by the entrepreneurial culture among the universities in San Francisco. It seemed like every professor worth his salt had either started his own company or was sitting on the boards of several biotech firms. At lunch, the conversation was all about tech transfer, cross-licensing, milestone payments, buyouts and payouts, foreground and background IPRs. By then, Karen, Rick's wife, had come into a substantial inheritance, and he realized he had enough capital to get started. The Bay Area was crowded with firms. There was intense competition for space and hiring. He decided to go to the area north of Los Angeles, where Amgen had set up their huge facility. Deal built a terrific modern plant, put bright research teams in place, and was on his way. His father and brothers came to visit. They were duly impressed.
But why wasn't she calling him back?
He looked at his watch. It was 9 o'clock. The kids should be in bed by now, and Karen should be home. The maid said she had gone out an hour before. She didn't know where. But Karen never left without her cell phone. She must have it with her. Why wasn't she calling him back? He didn't understand it, and it just made him nervous as hell. Here he was, alone in this damn city, with more beautiful women per square foot than he had ever seen in his life. True, they were plastic, lots of surgery, but they were also sexy as hell. Up ahead, he saw a schlumpy guy walking with a tall chick who was striding along on spike heels, and she was just a knockout. Black hair, smooth skin, and a hot, lean body. The schlumpy guy must have paid for her, but even so, he clearly didn't appreciate her. He was clutching his wine bottle like it was a baby, and appeared so nervous he was almost sweating. But that girl, Jesus, she was hot. 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 Why the hell, he thought, wasn't Karen calling him back?
Hey, Vasco said. Looky, look, it's that Biogen guy, walking around like he has nothing to do.
I see him,
Dolly said. She was about a block ahead of him.
Nope, never mind.
Tolman and the Russian girl walked right past the Biogen guy, who did nothing but flip open his phone and dial. What was his name?
Deal.
Vasco had heard something about him, started a company on his wife's dough, and now maybe she was in control of their marriage. Something like that. Rich broad. Old Eastern family. Lots of money. Those broads could wear the pants.
Restaurant, Dolly said. They're going in that terrazzo place. Il Terrazzo Antico was a two-story restaurant with glassed-in balconies. The decor was whorehouse modern. Gilded everything. Pillars, ceiling, walls. Every surface covered with decoration made Vasco jumpy just to look at it. The couple walked in, right past the reservation desk, heading for a side table. And at the table, Vasco saw a heavyset guy who looked like a thug, dark-skinned and heavy-browed. And the thug was looking at the Russian girl and practically licking his lips. Tolman marched right up to the table and spoke to the dark-skinned man.
The guy looked puzzled. He didn't invite them to sit. Vasco thought, something's wrong. The Russian girl had stepped back a pace. At that moment, a flash went off. Dolly had snapped a picture. The Tolman kid looked, took it all in, and bolted. Shit, Dolly! Vasco started running after Tolman, who was heading deeper into the restaurant. A waiter held up his hands.
Sir, excuse me.
Vasco knocked him flat, kept right on going. Tolman was ahead, moving slower than he might because he was trying not to shake his precious wine bottle. But he didn't know where he was going anymore. He didn't know the restaurant. He was just running. Whang! Through swinging doors into the kitchen, Vasco right after him. Everybody was yelling at them, and some of the cooks were waving knives. But Tolman pushed on, apparently convinced there was some sort of rear entrance to the kitchen. There wasn't. He was trapped. He looked around wildly. Vasco slowed. He flashed one of his badges in an official-looking wallet.
"Citizen's arrest," he said.
Tolman cowered back by two walk-in freezers and a narrow door with a slim vertical window. Tolman went through the narrow door, and it closed behind him. A light blinked by the door. It was a service elevator.
"Shit! Where does this go?"
"Second floor."
"Anywhere else?"
"No, just second floor."
Vasco pressed his earpiece.
"Dolly."
"I'm on it,"
she said. He heard her panting as she ran upstairs. Vasco positioned himself in front of the elevator door and waited. He pressed the button to bring the elevator down.
"I'm at the elevator now," Dolly said. "I saw him. He went back down."
"That's a tiny elevator," Vasco said.
"I know."
"If he's really got liquid nitrogen with him, he shouldn't be in there."
A couple of years back, Vasco had chased a fugitive into a laboratory supply warehouse. The guy had nearly suffocated after he locked himself in a closet. The elevator came down. As soon as it stopped, Vasco yanked the handle to open it. But Tolman must have pushed an emergency switch because the door wouldn't open. Vasco could see the wine sack on the floor. The velvet had been pushed down to reveal the stainless steel rim of the Dewar. And the top was off, white steam around the opening. Through the glass, Tolman stared at him, wild-eyed.
"Come out, son," Vasco said.
"Don't be foolish."
Tolman shook his head.
"It's dangerous," Vasco said. "You know it's dangerous."
But the kid pushed a button, and the elevator started back up. Vasco had a bad feeling. The kid knew all right. He knew exactly what he was doing.
"He's up here," Dolly said, standing on the second floor. "But the door won't open." "No, he's going down again."
"Go back to the table," Vasco said to her. "Let him go."
She realized at once what he was talking about. She hurried back down the plush red velvet staircase to the ground floor. She was not surprised to see that the table where the thuggish man had sat was now empty. No thug, no beautiful Russian girl, just a $100 bill tucked under a glass. He'd paid in cash, of course, and vanished. Vasco was now surrounded by three hotel security guys, all talking at once. Standing half a head above them, he yelled for quiet.
"One thing," he said. "How do we get the elevator open?"
"He must have hit the override."
"How do we get it open?"
"We have to kill the power to it."
"Will that open it?"
"No, but then we can wedge it open once it's stopped."
"How long will that take?"
"Maybe 10-15 minutes. Doesn't matter, this guy isn't going anyplace."
"Yes, he is," Vasco said.
The security guy laughed.
"Where the hell can he go?"
The elevator came down again. Tolman was on his knees, holding the glass door shut.
"Get up,"
Vasco said.
"Get up. Get up. Come on, son. It's not worth it. Stand up."
Suddenly, Tolman's eyes rolled up into his head, and he fell onto his back. The elevator started to rise.
"What the hell?"
one of the security men said.
"Who is he, anyway?"
"Oh, shit," Vasco thought.
The kid had pushed some override that had jammed the elevator circuits. It took them 40 minutes to get the doors open and haul him out. He was long since dead, of course. The instant he fell, he was immersed in 100% nitrogen atmosphere from the liquid nitrogen that was streaming from the doer. Because nitrogen was heavier than air, it progressively filled the elevator from the bottom up. Once the kid flopped on his back, he was already unconscious, and he would have died within a minute. The security guys wanted to know what was in the doer, which was no longer smoking. Vasco got some gloves and pulled out the long metal stick. There was nothing there. Just a series of empty clips where the embryo should have been. The embryos had been removed.
"You mean to say he killed himself?"
one of the security men said.
"That's right," Vasco said. "He worked in an embryology lab. He knew about the danger of liquid nitrogen in a confined space."
Nitrogen caused more laboratory fatalities than any other chemical. Half the people who died were trying to rescue co-workers who had collapsed in confined spaces.
"It was his way out of a bad situation," Vasco said.
Later, driving home with him, Dolly said,
"So what happened to the embryos?"
Vasco shook his head.
"No idea. The kid never got them."
"You think the girl took them? Before she went to his room?"
"Somebody took them," Vasco sighed. "The hotel doesn't know her?"
"They reviewed security cameras. They don't know her."
"And her student status?"
"University had her as a student last year. She didn't enroll this year."
"So she's vanished."
"Yeah," Dolly said. "Her, the dark-skinned guy, the embryos, everything vanished."
"I'd like to know how all this goes together," Vasco said.
"Maybe it doesn't," Dolly said.
"Wouldn't be the first time," Vasco said.
Up ahead, he saw the neon of a roadhouse in the desert. He pulled over. He needed a drink. Division 48 of Los Angeles Superior Court was a wood-paneled room dominated by the Great Seal of the State of California. The room was small and had a tawdry feeling. The reddish carpet was frayed and streaked with dirt. The wood veneer on the witness stand was chipped, and one of the fluorescent lights was out, leaving the jury box darker than the rest of the room. The jurors themselves were dressed casually in jeans and short-sleeved shirts. The judge's chair squeaked whenever the Honorable Davis Pike turned away to glance at his laptop, which he did often throughout the day. Alex Burnett suspected he was checking his email or his stocks. All in all, this courtroom seemed an odd place to litigate complex issues of biotechnology, but that was what they had been doing for the past 2 weeks in Frank M. Burnett versus Regents of the University of California. Alex was 32, a successful litigator, a junior partner in her law firm. She sat at the plaintiff's table with the other members of her father's legal team and watched as her father took the witness stand. Although she smiled reassuringly, she was, in fact, worried about how he would fare. Frank Burnett was a barrel-chested man who looked younger than his 51 years. He appeared healthy and confident as he was sworn in. Alex knew that her father's vigorous appearance could undermine his case. And, of course, the pretrial publicity had been savagely negative. Rick Deal's PR team had worked hard to portray her dad as an ungrateful, greedy, unscrupulous man, a man who interfered with medical research, a man who wouldn't keep his word, who just wanted money. None of that was true. In reality, it was the opposite of the truth. But not a single reporter had called her father to ask his side of the story, not one. Behind Rick Deal stood Jack Watson, the famous philanthropist. The media assumed that Watson was the good guy, and therefore her father was the bad guy. Once that version of the morality play appeared in the New York Times, written by the local entertainment reporter, everybody else fell into line. There was a huge Me Too piece in the L.A. Times, trying to outdo the New York version in vilifying her father. And the local news shows kept up a daily drumbeat about the man who wanted to halt medical progress, the man who dared criticize UCLA, that renowned center of learning, the great hometown university. A half dozen cameras followed her and her father whenever they walked up the courthouse steps. Their own efforts to get the story out had been singularly unsuccessful. Her father's hired media advisor was competent enough, but no match for Jack Watson's well-oiled, well-financed machine. Of course, members of the jury would have seen some of the coverage, and the impact of the coverage was to put added pressure on her father not merely to tell his story, but also to redeem himself, to contradict the damage already done to him by the press before he ever got to the witness stand. Her father's attorney stood and began his questions.
"Mr. Burnett, let me take you back to the month of June, some 8 years ago. What were you doing at that time?"
"I was working construction," her father said in a firm voice, "supervising all the welding on the Calgary natural gas pipeline."
"And when did you first suspect you were ill?"
"I started waking up in the night, soaking wet, drenched."
"You had a fever?"
"I thought so."
"You consulted a doctor?"
"Not for a while," he said. "I thought I had the flu or something. But the sweats never stopped. After a month, I started to feel very weak. Then I went to the doctor."
"And what did the doctor tell you?"
"He said I had a growth in my abdomen, and he referred me to the most eminent specialist on the West Coast, a professor at UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles."
"Who was that specialist?"
"Dr. Michael Gross, over there." Her father pointed to the defendant, sitting at the next table. Alex did not look over. She kept her gaze on her father.
"And were you subsequently examined by Dr. Gross?"
"Yes, I was."
"He conducted a physical exam?"
"Yes."
"Did he do any tests at that time?"
"Yes. He took blood, and he did x-rays and a CAT scan of my entire body, and he took a biopsy of my bone marrow."
"How was that done, Mr. Burnett?"
"He stuck a needle in my hip bone, right here. The needle punches through the bone and into the marrow. They suck out the marrow and analyze it."
"And after these tests were concluded, did he tell you his diagnosis?"
"Yes. He said I had acute T-cell lymphoblastic leukemia."
"What did you understand that disease to be?"
"Cancer of the bone marrow."
"Did he propose treatment?"
"Yes. Surgery and then chemotherapy."
"And did he tell you your prognosis? What the outcome of this disease was likely to be?"
"He said that it wasn't good."
"Was he more specific?"
"He said probably less than a year."
"Did you subsequently get a second opinion from another doctor?"
"Yes, I did."
"With what result?"
"My diagnosis was Gia. He confirmed the diagnosis."
Her father paused, bit his lip, fighting emotion. Alex was surprised. He was usually tough and unemotional. She felt a twinge of concern for him, even though she knew this moment would help his case.
"I was scared, really scared," her father said. "They all told me I didn't have long to live."
He lowered his head. The courtroom was silent. "Mr. Burnett, would you like some water?"
"No, I'm fine."
He raised his head, passed his hand across his forehead.
"Please continue when you're ready."
"I got a third opinion, too, and everybody said to me that Dr. Gross was the best doctor for this disease."
"So you initiated your therapy with Dr. Gross?"
"Yes, I did."
Her father seemed to have recovered. Alex sat back in her chair, took a breath. The testimony unrolled smoothly now, a story her father had told dozens of times before, how he, a scared and frightened man, fearing for his life, had put his faith in Dr. Gross, how he had undergone surgery and chemotherapy under the direction of Dr. Gross, how the symptoms of the disease had slowly faded over the course of the following year, how Dr. Gross had seemed at first to believe that her father was well, his treatment successfully completed.
You had follow-up examinations with Dr. Gross?
Yes. Every 3 months.
With what result?
Everything was normal. I gained weight. My strength came back. My hair grew back. I felt good.
And then what happened?
About a year later, after one of my checkups, Dr. Gross called to say he needed to do more tests.
Did he say why?
He said some of my blood work didn't look right.
Did he say which tests specifically?
No.
Did he say you still had cancer?
No, but that's what I was afraid of. He had never repeated any tests before. Her father shifted in his chair. I asked him if the cancer had come back, and he said, not at this point, but we need to monitor you very closely. He insisted I needed constant testing.
How did you react?
I was terrified. In a way, it was worse the second time. When I was sick the first time, I made my will, made all the preparations.
Then I got well, and I got a new lease on life, a chance to start over.
Then his phone call came, and I was terrified again.
You believed you were sick?
Of course. Why else would he be repeating tests?
You were frightened?
Terrified.
Watching the questioning, Alex thought, it's too bad we don't have pictures. Her father appeared vigorous and hearty. She remembered when he had been frail, gray, and weak. His clothes had hung on his frame. He looked like a dying man. Now he looked strong, like the construction worker he had been all his life. He didn't look like a man who became frightened easily. Alex knew these questions were essential to establish a basis for fraud and a basis for mental distress, but it had to be done carefully. And their lead lawyer, she knew, had a bad habit of ignoring his own notes once the testimony was rolling. The lawyer said,
"What happened next, Mr. Burnett?"
"I went in for tests. Dr. Gross repeated everything. He even did another liver biopsy."
"With what result?"
"He told me to come back in 6 months."
"Why?"
"He just said come back in 6 months."
"How did you feel at this time?"
"I felt healthy, but I figured I'd had a relapse."
"Dr. Gross told you that?"
"No, he never told me anything. Nobody at the hospital ever told me anything. They just said, come back in 6 months."
Naturally enough, her father believed he was still sick. He met a woman he might have married, but didn't because he thought he did not have long to live. He sold his house and moved into a small apartment so he wouldn't have a mortgage.
"It sounds like you were waiting to die,"
the attorney said. "Objection!"
"I'll withdraw the question, but let's move on. Mr. Burnett, how long did you continue going to UCLA for testing?"
4 years.
4 years.
"And when did you first suspect you were not being told the truth about your condition?"
"Well, 4 years later, I still felt healthy. Nothing had happened. Every day I was waiting for lightning to strike, but it never did. But Dr. Gross kept saying I had to come back for more tests, more tests. By then, I had moved to San Diego, and I wanted to have my test done there and sent up to him. But he said no, I had to do the tests at UCLA.
Why?
He said he preferred his own lab, but it didn't make sense. And he was giving me more and more forms to sign."
"What forms?"
"At first, they were just consent forms to acknowledge that I was undertaking a procedure with risk. Those first forms were 1 or 2 pages long. Pretty soon there were other forms that said I agreed to be involved in a research project. Each time I went back, there were still more forms. Eventually, the forms were 10 pages long, a whole document in dense legal language."
"And did you sign them?"
"Toward the end, no."
"Why not?"
"Because some of the forms were releases to permit the commercial use of my tissues."
"That bothered you?"
"Sure. Because I didn't think he was telling me the truth about what he was doing, the reason for all the tests."
On one visit, I asked Dr. Gross straight out if he was using my tissues for commercial purposes. He said, "Absolutely not. His interests were purely research. So I said, okay, and I signed everything except the forms allowing my tissues to be used for commercial purposes. And what happened? He got very angry. He said he would not be able to treat me further unless I signed all the forms, and I was risking my health and my future. He said I was making a big mistake. Objection, hearsay.
All right. Mr. Burnett, when you refused to sign the consent forms, did Dr. Gross stop treating you?
Yes.
And did you then consult a lawyer?
Yes.
And what did you subsequently discover?
That Dr. Gross had sold my cells,
the cells he took from my body during all these tests, to a drug company called Biogen. And how did you feel when you heard that?
I was shocked, her father said. I had gone to Dr. Gross when I was sick and scared and vulnerable. I had trusted my doctor. I had put my life in his hands. I trusted him. And then it turned out that he had been lying to me and scaring me needlessly for years just so he could steal parts of my own body from me and sell them to make a profit for himself. He never cared about me at all. He just wanted to take my cells.
Do you know what those cells were worth?
The drug company said $3 billion. The jury gasped.
Alex had been watching the jury all during the latest testimony. Their faces were impassive, but nobody moved, nobody shifted. The gasps were involuntary, evidence of how deeply engaged they were with what they were hearing, and the jury remained transfixed as the questions continued.
Mr. Burnett, did Dr. Gross ever apologize to you for misleading you?
No.
Did he ever offer to share his profit with you?
No.
Did you ask him to?
Eventually I did, yes, when I realized what he had already done.
They were my cells, from my body.
I thought I should have something to say about what was done with them.
But he refused?
Yes. He said it was none of my business what he did with my cells. The jury reacted to that. Several turned and looked at Dr. Gross. That was a good sign, too, Alex thought.
One final question, Mr. Burnett. Did you ever sign an authorization for Dr. Gross to use your cells for any commercial purposes?
No.
You never authorized their sale?
Never. But he did it anyway.
No further questions.
The judge called a 15-minute recess, and when the court reconvened, the UCLA attorneys began the cross-examination. For this trial, UCLA had hired Raper and Cross, a downtown firm that specialized in high-stakes corporate litigation. Raper represented oil companies and major defense contractors. Clearly, UCLA did not regard this trial as a defense of medical research. $3 billion were at stake. It was big business, and they hired a big business firm. The lead attorney for UCLA was Albert Rodriguez. He had a youthful, easy appearance, a friendly smile, and a disarming sense of seeming new at the job. Actually, Rodriguez was 45 and had been a successful litigator for 20 years, but he somehow managed to give the impression that this was his first trial, and he subtly appealed to the jury to cut him some slack.
Now, Mr. Burnett, I imagine it has been taxing for you to go over the emotionally draining experiences of the last few years. I appreciate your telling the jury your experiences, and I won't keep you long. I believe you told the jury that you were very frightened, as anyone would naturally be. By the way, how much weight had you lost when you first came to Dr. Gross?
Alex thought, uh-oh. She knew where this was going. They were going to emphasize the dramatic nature of the cure. She glanced at the attorney sitting beside her, who was clearly trying to think of a strategy. She leaned over and whispered, "Stop it!" The attorney shook his head, confused. Her father was saying, "I don't know how much I lost, about 40 or 50 pounds.
So your clothes didn't fit well?
Not at all.
And what was your energy like at that time? Could you climb a flight of stairs?
No. I'd go 2 or 3 steps and I'd have to stop.
From exhaustion?
Alex nudged the attorney at her side, whispered, "Asked and answered." The attorney immediately stood up.
"Objection, Your Honor. Mr. Burnett has already stated he was diagnosed with a terminal condition."
"Yes,"
Rodriguez said.
"And he has said he was frightened. But I think the jury should know just how desperate his condition really was."
"I'll allow it."
"Thank you. Now then, Mr. Burnett, you had lost a quarter of your body weight. You were so weak, you couldn't climb more than a couple of stairs, and you had a deadly serious form of leukemia. Is that right?"
"Yes."
Alex gritted her teeth. She wanted desperately to stop this line of questioning, which was clearly prejudicial and irrelevant to the question of whether her father's doctor had acted improperly after curing him. But the judge had decided to allow it to continue, and there was nothing she could do. And it wasn't egregious enough to provide grounds for appeal.
"And for help in your time of need," Rodriguez said, "you came to the best physician on the West Coast to treat this disease?"
"Yes."
"And he treated you?"
"Yes."
"And he cured you. This expert and caring doctor cured you."
"Objection, Your Honor. Dr. Gross is a physician, not a saint."
"Sustained."
"All right," Rodriguez said. "Let me put it this way. Mr. Burnett, how long has it been since you were diagnosed with leukemia?"
6 years.
"Is it not true that a 5-year survival in cancer is considered a cure?"
"Objection. Calls for expert conclusion."
"Sustained."
"Your Honor," Rodriguez said, turning to the judge, "I don't know why this is so difficult for Mr. Burnett's attorneys. I am merely trying to establish that Dr. Gross did, in fact, cure the plaintiff of a deadly cancer."
"And I," the judge replied, "don't know why it is so difficult for the defense to ask that question plainly without objectionable phrasing."
"Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Mr. Burnett, do you consider yourself cured of leukemia?"
"Yes."
"You are completely healthy at this time?"
"Yes."
"Who, in your opinion, cured you?"
"Dr. Gross."
"Thank you. Now, I believe you told the court that when Dr. Gross asked you to return for further testing, you thought that meant you were still ill."
"Yes."
"Did Dr. Gross ever tell you that you still had leukemia?"
"No."
"Did anyone in his office, or did any of his staff, ever tell you that?"
"No."
"Then," Rodriguez said, "if I understand your testimony, at no time did you have any specific information that you were still ill?"
"Correct."
"All right. Now let's turn to your treatment. You received surgery and chemotherapy. Do you know if you were given the standard treatment for T-cell leukemia?"
"No, my treatment was not standard."
"It was new?"
"Yes."
"Were you the first patient to receive this treatment protocol?"
"Yes, I was."
"Dr. Gross told you that?"
"Yes."
"And did he tell you how this new treatment protocol was developed?"
"He said it was part of a research program."
"And you agreed to participate in this research program?"
"Yes."
"Along with other patients with the disease?"
"I believe there were others, yes."
"And the research protocol worked in your case?"
"Yes."
"You were cured?"
"Yes."
"Thank you. Now, Mr. Burnett, you are aware that in medical research, new drugs to help fight disease are often derived from or tested on patient tissues."
"Yes."
"You knew your tissues would be used in that fashion?"
"Yes, but not for commercial—"
"I'm sorry. Just answer yes or no. When you agreed to allow your tissues to be used for research, Did you know they might be used to derive or test new drugs?
Yes.
And if a new drug was found, did you expect the drug to be made available to other patients?
Yes.
Did you sign an authorization for that to happen?
A long pause. Then, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. I have no further questions.
How do you think it went? Her father asked as they left the courthouse. Closing arguments were the following day. They walked toward the parking lot in the hazy sunshine of downtown Los Angeles.
Hard to say, Alex said. They confused the facts very successfully. We know there's no new drug that emerged from this program, but I doubt the jury understands what really happened. We'll bring in more expert witnesses to explain that UCLA just made a cell line from your tissues and used it to manufacture a cytokine, the way it is manufactured naturally inside your body. There's no new drug here, but that'll probably be lost on the jury. And there's also the fact that Rodriguez is explicitly shaping this case to look exactly like the Moore case a couple of decades back. Moore was a case very much like yours. Tissues were taken under false pretenses and sold. UCLA won that one, easily, though they shouldn't have.
So, Counselor, how does our case stand?
She smiled at her father, threw her arm around his shoulder, and kissed him on the cheek. Truth, it's uphill, she said. Barry Sindler, divorce lawyer to the stars, shifted in his chair. He was trying to pay attention to the client seated across the desk from him, but he was having trouble. The client was a nerd named Deal, who ran some biotech company. The guy talked abstractly, no emotion, practically no expression on his face, even though he was telling how his wife was screwing around on him. Deal must have been a terrible husband, but Barry wasn't sure how much money there was in this case. It seemed the wife had all the money. Deal droned on how his first suspicions arose when he called her from Las Vegas, how he discovered the charge slips for the hotel that she went to every Wednesday, how he waited in the lobby and caught her checking in with a local tennis pro. Same old California story. Barry had heard it 100 times. Didn't these people know they were walking cliches? Outraged husband catches wife with the tennis pro. They wouldn't even use that one on Desperate Housewives. Barry gave up trying to listen. He had too much on his mind this morning. He had lost the Kokorovich case, and it was all over town. Just because DNA tests had shown that it wasn't the billionaire's baby. And then the court wouldn't award him his fees, even though he had cut them to a measly 1.4 mil. The judge gave him a quarter of that. Every damn lawyer in town was gloating, because they all had it in for Barry Sindler. He had heard that L.A. Magazine was doing a big story on the case, sure to be unfavorable to Barry. Not that he gave a crap about that. The truth was, the more he got portrayed as an unprincipled, ruthless prick, the more clients flocked to him. Because when it came to a divorce, people wanted a ruthless prick. They lined up for one. And Barry Sindler was, without a doubt, the most ruthless, unscrupulous, publicity-hungry, self-aggrandizing, stop-at-nothing, son-of-a-bitch divorce lawyer in Southern California, and proud of it. No, Barry didn't worry about any of those things. He didn't even worry about the house he was building in Montana for Denise and her 2 rotten kids. He didn't worry about the renovations on their house in Holmby Hills, even though the kitchen alone was costing $500K, and Denise kept changing the plans. Denise was a serial renovator. It was a disease. No, no, no. Barry Sindler worried about just one thing, the lease. He had one whole floor in an office building on Wilshire in Doheny, 23 attorneys in his office, none of them worth a shit, but seeing all of them at their desks impressed the clients.
and they could do the minor stuff like take depositions and file delaying motions, stuff Barry didn't want to be bothered with. Barry knew that litigation was a war of attrition, especially in custody cases. The goal was to run the costs as high as you could and stretch the proceedings out as long as you could, because that way Barry earned the largest possible fees, and the spouse eventually got tired of the endless delays, the new filings, and, of course, the spiraling costs. Even the richest of them eventually got tired. By and large, husbands were sensible. They wanted to get on with their lives, buy a new house, move in with the new girlfriend, get a nice blowjob. They wanted custody issues settled. But the wives usually wanted revenge. So Barry kept things from being settled year after year until the husbands caved. Millionaires, billionaires, celebrity assholes, it didn't matter. They all caved in the end. People said it wasn't a good strategy for the kids. Well, screw the kids. If the clients cared anything about the kids, they wouldn't get divorced in the first place. They'd stay married and miserable like everybody else because... The nerd had said something that jogged him back to attention.
I'm sorry, Barry Sindler said. Run that by me again, Mr. Deal. What did you just say?
I said, I want my wife tested.
I can assure you, these proceedings will test her to the limit. And of course we'll put a detective on her, see how much she drinks, whether she does drugs, stays out all night, has lesbian affairs, all that, standard procedure.
No, no, Deal said. I want her tested genetically.
For what?
For everything, he said.
Ah, Barry said, nodding wisely. What the hell was this guy talking about? Genetic testing? In a custody case?
He glanced down at the papers in front of him and the business card. Richard Rick Deal, Ph.D. Barry frowned unhappily. Only assholes put a nickname on the card. The card said he was CEO of Biogen Research Incorporated, some company out in Westview Village. For example, Deal said, I'll bet my wife has a genetic predisposition to bipolar illness. She certainly acts erratic. She might have the Alzheimer's gene. If she does, psychological tests could show early signs of Alzheimer's.
Good. Very good.
Barry Sindler was nodding vigorously now. This was making him happy. Fresh, new disputed areas. Sindler loved disputed areas. Administer the psychological test. Did the test show early Alzheimer's or not? Who the fuck could say for sure? Wonderful, wonderful. Whatever the test results, they would be disputed. More days in court, more expert witnesses to interview, battles of the doctorates dragging on for days. Days in court were especially lucrative. And best of all, Barry realized that this genetic testing could become standard procedure for all custody cases. Sindler was breaking new ground here. He'd get publicity for this. He leaned forward eagerly.
Go on, Mr. Deal.
Test her for the diabetes gene, breast cancer from the BRCA genes, and all the rest. And, Deal continued, my wife might also have the gene for Huntington's disease, which causes fatal nerve degeneration. Her grandfather had Huntington, so it's in her family. Both her parents are still young, and the disease only shows up when you're older. So my wife could be carrying the gene, and that would mean a death sentence from Huntington's.
Yes, Barry Sindler said, nodding. That could render her unfit to be the primary caregiver to the children.
Exactly.
I'm surprised she hasn't been tested already,